Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks, your podcast that brings together leaders, movies, and snacks.
Joining me is my co-pilot, Ed Hoffman.
Jessica, great to see you.
Do you know what I should just say? I should just say, I'm Jessica Fox. I'm a friend of Ed.
A foe. I'm a friend of Fox. I'm a fof.
We're being produced by the amazing Ben Please.
Absolutely. You know, Ben is amazing, and I consider myself a friend of Please, or a fop.
Thank you to Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light for making this episode possible.
Looking forward to seeing where we're going to go right now.
We're here to send one of our favorite people, Willeke Hoos, CEO of the Resource Alliance, to the moon.
Who is a descendant of Rembrandt. I will hold to that until proven wrong.
Moon snacks. Food for the mind.
Any chance you're related to Rembrandt?
Yeah, I share his surname. I was born in the same village, the same city in Leiden.
Leiden. Yeah.
Nobody can make the final connect.
Well, it's like 500 years in the past, but okay.
Well, look, can you describe a little bit about who you are and what you do?
My name is Willeke van Rijn, Dutch. I live in London at the moment. And I work for an organization called Resource Alliance. I'm the CEO of the Resource Alliance. And the Resource Alliance is a global community of over 30,000 fundraisers, campaigners, change makers in the social impact sector that have decided that by sharing new innovative solutions, we can create impact faster. So it's a beautiful community to work with. I just came back from India, where we had a beautiful conference in India, where we had 700 people in Delhi coming together. And at this time, actually, it was bringing philanthropists, funders, fundraisers together to really see how they can create a better impact in India.
And you always say, if people can't sit down at the table and talk to each other, then nothing gets done. It's really about if people will sit down and work together.
Conversation is the key. Now, that's humans. Our friend Larry used to say, dogs build trust by smelling each other. Humans, fortunately, don't do that, but we build trust by talking together, eating and drinking together. But I got to tell you, I'm just so excited. I am probably going to put on my LinkedIn something like In the Footsteps of Van Rijn.
I feel like Willeke is the perfect person to send to the moon because she's able to inspire and rally people. And actually, Willeke, when we first started the show, we were like, oh, we're going to send individuals to the moon. They have 3 movies to take with them. We didn't actually start appreciating we're creating a colony of people on the moon that are our favorite people, basically. So although we're sad to send you away, you might be desperately needed. Well, there's something romantic about the moon. You know, it offers perspective back on Earth. It's kind of a fresh start. There's something welcoming about the moon. So, Willeke, can you kick it off? What is the first movie that you will bring with you?
Well, because we are talking so much about the moon already and looking back at the planet, I really thought when I would be kind of stuck on the moon, I really would love to know all that is happening on planet Earth. So my first one is definitely the documentary series about planet Earth. For me, it's showing the incredible presence of so many different things alive under the water, growing from the soil. It's fascinating. And I think sometimes we forget, in our day-to-day life, what an amazing place planet Earth actually is. I once met a cameraman from planet Earth in Goa, and we all decided to kind of broadcast it on a very big wall while everyone was sitting on the beach, looking at this kind of wall where it was projected upon. And while being already in a beautiful surrounding, actually seeing the beauty of other parts of the world.
100 years ago, there were 1.5 billion people on Earth. Now, over 6 billion crowd our fragile planet. But even so, there are still places barely touched by humanity. This series will take you to the last wildernesses and show you the planet and its wildlife as you have never seen them before.
Well, look, you have this insatiable thirst for life, for cultures, for seeing things, for communicating, for gathering people together. I'm trying to rewind the clock back. Were you like that when you were little?
I think I always really had it. I grew up about 100 meters away from the sea. So my childhood was playing on the beach, you know, and looking out over those waves and to a horizon that is just so far away. So it really makes you curious about what is out there. And you might say from the Netherlands, that might be England, but it's that broader perspective. I would have loved to be a globetrotter, I think, in the past, because that's the other part. I love meeting people and new cultures and different ways of living as well. And what do you explore there? And often it's a beautiful thing, I think, what you bump into or what you see or where you end up.
And did you know, is David Attenborough as big in the States?
Huge. Love David Attenborough. He's so good at what he does. It takes away from other beautiful documentaries because he's that prominent. You know, one of the things that I wonder is as a CEO for what you're trying to do, Planet Earth is about interconnectedness. It's about how everything is connected and the photography and the work is it'll take you to a puddle dropping in the water. And then it'll show a fly that goes in there and a fish that's, everything is connected. Is that how you see yourself also as a CEO, as a leader? Do you leverage those skills and expect those from the team that you have that we're all connected to a larger system?
When you really start thinking about how are we connected and why are we really here, it really always starts for me with purpose. You know, if that purpose is not there, then yeah, you can maybe end up swimming, but you don't know swimming towards or maybe against the stream. So for me, it's really important that the team really knows what their added value or their role is within creating that purpose. And then beyond it, I completely agree with the linking and the connecting what we do across the world. And there, it's fascinating, even while things might be different in one area versus another area, that connectedness is still there. You know, it might still end up as being a building block that somebody has created in Brazil that actually somebody in India can use as well, even while it has to be adapted towards local culture or the local organization or the local structures and policies that are in place. But the world is in that perspective really beautiful. So it is celebrating diversity and it is celebrating connectedness. And I think these two often are seen as opposites, while I strongly believe they're very much aligned.
And a celebration of challenges, I think, too, right? Leading anybody, leading a team or getting them to go in a direction is really difficult because each of us are unique. But I totally agree with the notion of if you can see that mission, if you can see that purpose that matters to us, then that defines, okay, here's the opportunity and the problem. And we start, you know, going towards that. The unique skills that we bring in is how we work it really smart and effectively together. And that comes through, I think, so much in Planet Earth. It's beautifully done so that it doesn't depress you in terms of problems. But it communicates we have challenges here if we want to maintain this.
For me, one other thing about Planet Earth is you were mentioning about David Attenborough. He's really known. I think he's a great storyteller. The narrative that he's mentioning continuously is so important. I think he was slightly challenged at a certain moment to raise his voice more about climate change. And when he started doing that, he got such a big understanding from it. So in a way, I think he's a role model about, you know, sticking to your topic. This is my purpose. This is my area of work. Here is my expertise. But I'm really, I don't know, he's so driven. He never stops really talking about it and the beauty of what he has to share. And it is often not, I don't know, he's not so talking about a doom scenario alone. He's always showcasing the beauty of it. And that's something I really want to maybe learn even more. You know, how can you become that strong voice that showcases the beauty of what the planet has to offer?
I love that. I'm picturing you on kind of the desolate moon, with like a big screen watching these incredibly luscious and gorgeous, thriving images from Earth. And so I love that contrast. You surround yourself with life-affirming things. I think that's wonderful. And also, one thing that I took away from Planet Earth is not only our interconnectedness, but our circumstance is so dependent on the climate. As Ed said, you know, he does it in a very almost positive way. So it doesn't feel overwhelming. But in your line of work, for people who may not be familiar with the work that you do, are there certain factors that you feel really determine in terms of climate, in terms of collaboration, in terms of policy, whatever they are, that determine the success or how things are thriving?
Yeah, well, we work with the social impact sector. So they are nonprofit organizations, but we actually say it's more than nonprofit organizations alone. It's social enterprises who really set purpose, impact before profit. And sometimes there are even individuals who have created movements. You know, think about the recent movements. A Me Too movement was created by an individual. Black Lives Matter came out of individuals and less out of the organized and structured nonprofit organizations. And within that broad range of entities, people, we really want to exchange best practices. And that means that people need to open up. So a crucial element for us is, do you trust each other? Do you see each other as a supporting element over competition? Also, when you're looking at, you know, getting attention for certain topics, are you addressed in the media or somebody else? You know, are you getting the funding from a philanthropist or somebody else? And there, you know, that's trust building and saying, if we actually operate together, we can achieve much more. And I will not see you as a competitor is really crucial. And that, for me, is the driving element for success.
Does that resonate with you, Ed, about the work you did at NASA?
At the start of this conversation, Jessica, you used a word that I was exactly thinking about, which was one of the books that Buzz Aldrin did was called Magnificent Desolation. And it's being on the moon, and you could look at it one way as, oh, man, there's nothing here, it's desolate, and would describe it as this magnificence, beauty. And so you can play that from the standpoint of what you're doing as a leader going towards a destination. How do we do this? But you can also do it as an appreciation for all different parts of Earth, right? Desert and ocean and mountains and all of that. So there's a beauty to what's taking place. In terms of the connection, I guess one of the questions I have for you is, how do you go about being the best leader that you can be? So if I talk to members of your team, if I spoke to members of the team, what would they say are the things that make you someone that people want to be led by?
They would say that they love my drive and energy towards purpose. They love the freedom that they get. I challenge them to kind of grow and to get over a hurdle and to almost achieve or do more than they think they're capable of. Sometimes I think they could say I'm impatient, you know, so there's also an other side to it.
We sound very similar. I heard these things. One of the critiques when I was doing with the NASA team, you may have been part of that, I was getting feedback, most of it about very people-oriented, very driven towards a goal, very passionate. The critique I had was moving too fast.
But I'm open for feedback. Let's say it in that way. And they would sometimes say, oh, you can be so, you know, full on, even while we know that you mean everything in a really meant way and in that kind of passionate way. And I think it's linked, and that you and I might have in common as well, Ed. It's really about believing that this big dream is possible. You know, if you don't believe that we definitely can end extreme poverty, or if we don't believe that gender equity is an option in this planet, you know, that we really can balance it out, or that we can make a change if you're talking about climate, or there is a big element at the moment around which is called shift the power. And that's, for example, in the African continent, where they say we do not want to be dependent anymore on US funding. Some of that has come a little bit abrupt at the moment with the stop of USAID. But, you know, that whole discussion and moving that into action is really happening. And there we sometimes forget, I think, to showcase where the best practices are. And by doing so, it gives a lot of stimulants to others to make it happen. So, yeah, those are big dreams, but big dreams that we can change into reality.
Do you know what I find this so beautiful? Because there first is an instigator. I use that word with the greatest respect. So the person who has the vision that then says, this is possible, I feel it, I can taste it, I know it's possible, and it should happen. Not just it can happen, it really should happen. And they come forth with this energy, and I find that there is a magic to attrition. So there is a moment where you then start sharing your vision with the people around you. And it is you feel the transition. You feel when it happens when your team or your group starts carrying that belief together. There's this really good YouTube clip of a guy at a concert, and he's on a big hill and he's dancing alone. He's the only person dancing. Do you know this one?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
And so he's dancing alone. He's having a great time. And a guy walks by him. He kind of looks at him and looks at the concert, looks at him again, just starts to decide to dance with him. And it's that moment that everyone gets the idea that maybe we should be dancing, and they join in. There is, I'm sure scientists probably could see it in energy. There's that transference of energy that happens when you're trying to lead a team. And it takes people like you to get that started. It really does.
Both of you are pro disruptors. I think disruption is good, right? Provocation is good. But it should be pro. It should be positive. We don't need negative, energies that are being thrown out there. So,
in terms of the art of taking feedback as a leader, is something we haven't talked about on the show yet. Can you tell us about when you decide to take the feedback seriously and shift behavior, and when you kind of consider it but maybe shelf it?
We have a virtual team, and my team is partially based across the globe. I've got a member in India, and there's a team member in Uganda. So we do it especially at moments when we are together. And we use a lot of personality tests. It could be a Myers-Briggs. It could be what kind of color comes out. It could be sometimes a culture map as well. And that is by doing those exercises and starting a conversation about how are you, how are we, and how do we communicate with each other, you start from a different level than, oh, we are fine and everything is okay. You know, it's giving some topics to start talking about. And these are really moments that are fun. They're often really fun, actually, to discuss them. I'm very aware I have quite a couple of perfectionists on my team, and I'm far from a perfectionist. I'm an initiator, but not necessarily a finisher. So in my team, that's perfect, but it also means that, yeah, we do things different. I've got introverts and I'm an extreme extrovert. I love discussing things with my team or with somebody, while others like to read things slowly first. And I think that understanding is really crucial, therefore, to give feedback and to receive feedback.
There is an assessment that you had to get done through NASA at some point, like a personality assessment, but also at the end of the year, a feedback assessment. And I got a call and they said, look, we really can't make heads or tails out of some of the feedback we're getting about you. So we're just going to read you the feedback. We can't, like, they couldn't really ascribe it to anything. And one of them was, Jessica's too tall. When she talks to me, I feel like she's looking down on me. That was one of them. And then the other one is, every time Jessica talks to me, it reminds me of my mother yelling at me.
Wow. You provoke a lot of intensity there.
Well, I was like, I don't understand. I was so self-conscious and I didn't understand where this was coming from. And then only a month later did I figure it out. And they had called people who, personal contacts of mine, apparently, to also send in feedback about. Anyway, my friend Aaron had gotten a call from NASA. And he thought it was a crank call. Like, he thought, he like didn't believe it. And so he decided to give the most wild feedback that he could.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, imagine. And it broke their system. Willika, can we have your second film? Planet Earth's wonderful, and I know we'll keep you good company.
Yeah, but it's the same with my second one, because the second one is really focused on people, Baraka. I love that documentary. I love the film. And it's really about, you know, these amazing people that live on planet Earth. And I think we have hardly explored a part of it. Different settings, different societies, different ways of living. And it's always challenging about who's living in a crazy way here. You know, is it me or is it the other person? It is putting a mirror in front of your face continuously about so many ways how we can explore and live life. And for me, it's always a big learning part. So it's definitely why I travel. It's definitely why I love meeting different people. But this film is, I think it's a celebration of human beings.
You have to see on the big screen. I feel like it doesn't work on a phone.
That's really true. It was a long time ago, but very recently there has been a second edition coming out, which is called Samsara. And I saw that about, I think, a year ago, which was really beautiful to see on the big screen. It was actually when I recently moved to London, and it was a beautiful movie to see. Yeah.
And this was shot on, I was reading about it, shot on 70 millimeter. And, you know, he had to invent a particular kind of camera in order to do this work. So there's a lot of human invention and passion and vision for actually being able to pull off a film like this itself. So it goes back to some of the things we were talking about. And I sent this quote to Ed by Roger Ebert. He basically said that, like the Voyager, if you're going to carry one film into space, this would be the film. So, Willika, you kind of like won the lottery. I feel like you chose the jackpot movie.
You know, they did it with the songs, wasn't it? With the Beatles songs that they once sent into space. So I would definitely add this one to it. If you want to understand humanity, here is a starting point.
If an alien did see that, let's say you went into space and you were able to share it, what would they take away from it?
For me, it provides diversity. It provides beauty. It provides such a warm and loving feeling, I think, if you see it already. It's a curiosity, but a curiosity set in a beautiful, it's not a setting, but it's just, it's almost like people are good, you know? I think it's a celebration of humanity. And I would argue it's very welcoming. So if it was an outsider, you could say, have a look at this. It's all okay, you know, we can be friends. Yeah, you can be part of all these different groups there.
And it is welcoming without ignoring darker aspects of humanity.
If I were an alien, I think I would think this planet is schizophrenic. It, again, I go to the working, this would almost be a beautiful SWOT analysis of, you see these amazing strengths that give you awe. And then you see other images and wars and poverty that, man, there's a lot of problems over there. I rewatched again yesterday on a 70-inch TV screen. And I remember one scene where you're just watching the clouds just move over these mountains. And it's this motion and this movement and this sense of opportunity. But other aspects of it, you know, the top of these mountains, there's a threat there. So I almost see it as this amazing documentary that highlights the beauty, the wonder, but also, man, what are you folks got serious problems over there? How come it isn't more integrated? But it's an amazing work of art, I think, in what it does.
It's funny what you're saying about, you know, the challenges as well, because one thing that definitely stayed with me is the beauty of it. So I do not know if that is me, you know, the idealistic, positive, outward-looking person. I always believe in the good, in a way.
But I think if I hadn't, so I had watched it when it first came out, like 20 years ago. And before I watched it yesterday, my this is kind of like Planet Earth. This is going to be beautiful and amazing and wonderful and the glories of humanity. And you have that, but then you see other scenes of war. And, you know, what's going on there. And so it's a lot of different things that are taking place there that are embedded, you know, in terms of it's a lot of your work is about, I think you used earlier, transformation. And how do you do transformation from the standpoint of there are wonderful things and wonderful people and there's wonderful outcomes, but then there's also aspects that aren't going where we need to go.
And also don't shy away from addressing the problem. Problem is a reality, and there are quite some problems that we have to address. So believing that another world is possible, or that a solution is possible, or daring to dream big and really creating that path how to reach it is one part, but it is also the acknowledgement of there is an issue here, and there is an issue, and it's also 2025, and should that issue still exist?
But there are always problems in any kind of a system. You always want to get better. And I always look at the challenges are almost a gift in terms of for society, a gift from God, a gift from wherever, that without challenges, you get complacent. We have everything we want, and there's no reason to do anything. When I was young, the John Lennon song Imagine came out. And for whatever in my warped mind, I kept coming back to where if this were the case, there would be just nothing happening. Because there's a nilness in some ways, but through problems, through challenges, through we need to go there. One of the beauties of sending you to the moon is the challenges of getting you there safely and surviving and making sure the movies are in pristine. So challenges, I think, are beautiful for humanity. We live for art, for science, and for hard things.
I completely agree with that. And it also puts things in perspective afterwards. You know, if once you've been challenged, or you look at life in a different way, and you respect more of that what is there already.
And the people that are working with you, that's why it should be global. I mean, the thing I loved about NASA was the global nature that I guess I've been proven wrong, but you're not going to go to war with someone that you're collaborating with. Right? You're going to see them as people, you're going to eat together, you're going to understand, you're going to laugh together. And in that journey, you learn to work. My background was learning and development. I always used to argue the best way to do it is get people together to work on something or to dance around something. Once people learn together, then they work together beautifully.
We have a beautiful cohort of African grassroots organizations, 20 organizations from 14 African countries. And the knowledge and expertise that is already within that group is outstanding. So that learning, I always say it's learning from and with each other. They expect us to get a lot of expertise, knowledge from outside of the cohort, but then actually realize there's a lot already by simply bringing 20 organizations, 20 people together.
Can you give us an insight about what led you to the Resource Alliance? How did you get onto this path?
Funny enough, I started working at an IT company in a marketing area, but I have to say, within an IT company, it's such a creative surrounding, you know, that what is not there can be created. And I always loved it. Yeah, I started working while actually I really wanted to travel the world. I grew up in a small place in the Netherlands, and it felt like the rest of the Netherlands wasn't far enough for me. I was really curious about the world. And I had a very strong attraction to Latin America, which was quite unusual. A lot of people wanted to go to Asia, to Africa, but I wanted to go to Latin America. So after 4 years working for that IT organization, which was a beautiful group of people, and I absolutely loved working there, I needed to fulfill, I think, my personal dream. And I traveled for over a year, met fantastic people, and came back to the Netherlands and thought, you know what, I've got the answer. I need to work for an international IT company that will sort me out right now. And that wasn't really the answer. So I really moved from what I would call profit optimization to impact optimization, and that became a very clear choice. So I resigned. I worked for Oxfam. And Oxfam brought me in kind of startup situations in India, where I supported the startup of Oxfam India. I worked and lived a couple of years in Mexico. And while I thought that by living abroad or working abroad, that would provide me all the answers from the world, I actually ended up with even more on the questions. But I think that is the beauty of what traveling does. And yeah, also having the opportunity of living and working in different places really does. I spent, after Oxfam, I spent 2 years in a very rural, one of the poorest districts in Nepal. It's called Jumla. And there I didn't want to be associated with any organization, really understanding how do people live. Where do you start, and really become a listening ear and an observer instead of coming in with a mission from a nonprofit organization to say, oh, we are going to achieve something here or there. I'm a big fan of humble leaders.
I totally agree. I think that's humility comes from recognizing that the team brings the capability and what we know and what we don't know. And I was also thinking one of the places I always thought was so many paradoxes, India. So I spent a good amount of time in the South. I saw some of the most amazing things I've ever seen in the world. And I saw other things around people that were heartbreaking. And having to deal with the dichotomy was one of the biggest challenges I sometimes found, more than I think any place else that I've been. But again, it's this just amazing, beautiful place of architecture and art and history and nature. And then you see individuals who've been left out, forgotten.
It does for me two things. One is you definitely see that there is a solution possible, because you see the financially richness in the country like India, and it is all about distribution. The other thing is around, what do we call poverty? You know, we often generalize the word of being poor or living in poverty, but sometimes it's simply not having sufficient financial resources, because the knowledge and expertise that is available with local farmers, with local communities on creating solutions or building on solutions that they've grown up with and are, you know, moving from generation to generation, we absolutely have to start there and again be a listening ear before, you know, moving everyone to a solution we think is the answer, but it's definitely not the answer for them.
I think as humans, we sometimes emphasize economics and tangibles too much as a way to avoid human issues. I've come to the conclusion the biggest thing that people fear are people, even more than public speaking and that kind of stuff. And yet the issues are really around humanity. And the thing that hurts me most is where you see individuals or groups that are just totally left. I mean, they're not seen. Who tells the stories? Who gets in the movies? Who gets to stand up? And all over is such an important issue. And so, yeah, there's an economic thing. But even worse than that, in many cases, there's just being walked past or not heard.
Look, I think that's so interesting. You know, there is, Ed, to build upon that, about the people being afraid of other people. There is a story by, I think, Davy Rothbart, who created Found Magazine. And he was living in an apartment complex that caught on fire. And he said that everybody basically in the middle of the night had to leave the apartment complex, and they were standing there in their pajamas carrying what they could. And they stood next to each other in dead silence. No one talked to each other, no turned to each other and said, hi neighbor, finally nice to meet you, are you doing okay? No one did. And he was so upset by it, he didn't know who to talk to. So he thought, who would know the answer to why that happened? And he called Mr. Rogers. Do you know Mr. Rogers, Willika? He was a children's television show host that was like the kindest man on the planet. So he called Mr. Rogers and he was like, Mr. Rogers, this is what happened. Why? And Mr. Rogers thought about it and said, you know, I think we're afraid when we open ourselves up to someone, we're not going to find another human on the other end. And I was like, for Mr. Rogers to say that, that really kind of blew my mind. But that fear of the lack of humanity in other people, I think, keeps us from really empathizing or doing a lot. And the recognition of other people's humanity kind of accelerates amazing things and change.
It's the biggest challenge, connectivity. Our fear of...
In terms of relationships, was there a highlight sometime that a collaboration or a sharing of knowledge or a moment in a conference that stands out to you?
We talk in our conferences a lot around leaders and leadership. And often that is seen as you only can become a leader of when you're a certain age. And what we try to do is actually kind of break that stigma and end the conference always with what I call incredible heroes, who have done amazing things in their lives and still doing that. And there was a beautiful woman at our global conference in October last year. Her name is Archana, and she's from the Dalit, the lower caste background. And she said, you know, my dream one day is that I can walk on flip-flops to school instead of with my bare feet. her mother really supported her going to school. And at a certain moment, she realized that a lot of girls would drop out at a certain age because there were toilets, but the toilets were not working. And it means young girls come at a menstruation age, and that is the big dropout rate in the country, in India, we are talking about. She decided that this was ridiculous, and she started her personal campaign in front of the ministry's house and demanded that he would really pay attention towards it. And of course, this took time, but she got, you know, a gathering, and she didn't want to stop. And the minister completely turned around and provided working toilets for over 50,000 schools in her district. And by doing so, she's actually saying now, you know, if I can achieve that, let's make it happen and let's go to the next challenge. But she's also saying, if I personally can achieve that, there are so many other young women who can achieve that. So let's train them to become leaders. You know, we all know these local heroes, or these local heroes, meaning in my case, we work very global, but this is an hero in a big country like India in her local area, and is really creating a change there. And it is showing, yes, it is possible.
Amongst these incredible documentary, absolute beautiful visual collage documentary without like a non-narrative structure, what is the third film?
Yeah, now we go completely the other end. I thought I need some entertainment as well when I'm on the moon, and I think, you know what, just give me a nice James Bond movie. It is absolutely my guilty pleasure. I cannot explain it. I do not know why, but it is really my guilty pleasure. I don't know if it's the, you know, the Britishness in it or the English part in it, although he's Scottish, which I really like. I don't know what it is. I will have a difficulty explaining that also related to my work. But I think everyone needs a guilty pleasure, and this is definitely mine, and I decided to just mention it. So yeah, and I went for Skyfall because Skyfall is a big part of Skyfall is set in Scotland, and Scotland absolutely stole my heart when I lived there. And it has this, I think it is showcasing probably one of the most beautiful glens. It's Glen Etive. You know, it's on the way when you go up to Glencoe, which is already stunning, and then you have this tiny side road which is Glen Etive, and it's just a beautiful part of Scotland. And it doesn't matter, whenever you go there, every time it touches you when you hit that point there at Etive Moor.
No one has yet claimed responsibility for what sources are calling a possible cyber terrorist assault on the British Secret Service. Early reports from the scene indicate at least 6 dead, many more injured, with victims being evacuated to local hospitals within minutes of the explosion.
Completely 180 turn. It's you took us from the beauty and spectacular nature of Earth to betrayal. That is one of my two favorite Bond movies. In many ways, it's such a not Bond movie, because you get into, first of all, you get the aging thing, which I appreciate. I mean, I was there when they started Bond 1, right? And now it's in its 20s. So you see the aging of Bond and of M, his longtime, you know, partner. And all the acting of Judi Dench and Javier Bardem is just amazing. Daniel Craig, but you have this trio of people who are angry, and they're older, and they're kind of getting tired, and they're being questioned by other things. And so you get this sense of the world of betrayal, as well as the need to take care of what matters ultimately, but also that lingering sense of, you know, we're getting older, and how does that change perceptions of that? What a brilliant, brilliant movie. Great choice. I would not have anticipated that from the first time.
Well, it fits with me. You know, I'm a little bit of the extremes at times.
Oh, you're a disruptor. Yeah, you're a disruptor.
Yeah, that's true.
I love Skyfall too, but I could argue for the flavor of escapism, you have an adventurer, someone who loves to have adventures, whose work is their passion, who has a sense of personal principles that, although they work within an organization, they're a little bit of an outlier within that organization. So there's I think, a lot of kindred elements that are super appealing on top of just being like a really good popcorn movie. If you're going to get a movie, you got everything in there. You got good action, great actors, great scenery, great soundtrack.
And it's a leader's movie, because when you think about it, it's this tremendous transformation from the old evil people who were threats to us physically in different ways to now a whole different world that's starting of cyber and digital and almost hidden terrors, right? So it is about transformation. And that's partly what these characters are dealing with. You know, they, you know, how do you want to keep up with where things are going?
Also, you know, you can, I know, Ed, you can sense this already, but when you meet Willica, you'll really see Willica's like one of the coolest people I know. She just has like an inner cool factor, and Bond has the same thing.
What's your favorite cocktail? That's the next question.
A martini is quite nice, I have to admit.
Future-oriented, if you had a crystal ball, what are some of your hopes or visions for your organization, for where you think things are headed in the sector?
We were mentioning earlier about being schizophrenic. I sometimes think I'm a bit schizophrenic because I believe in two elements. And that is, in one hand, I really believe that as human beings, we can link and connect and create a force for good, you know? And good meaning, we can make change happen. And at the same time, that's the other side, I also very strongly believe in the small is beautiful. So everything starts within your own surrounding. And I always feel like Scottish communities are, you know, a beautiful example of that. And there I'm always a bit yo-yoing. Is it the one or is it the other? And very likely it's both. And my work is often linked to identifying those small and beautiful ideas and try to share or connect them with other parts of the world, while at the same time seeing that around certain topics, maybe we can build bigger movements to create that force. When we had our last conference, there were 800 people in the room, of which they represented 450 organizations. Those 450 organizations reached out via their programmatic work, via campaigning activities, people raising their voice or signing a petition, people giving a donation. They're reaching out over 1 billion people. If you know that, and people are in the room saying, oh, we don't know what is happening, we can't make change, nothing is happening, it's like, well, think again. Think again, because if we all start connecting here, 1 billion is absolutely crazy. And then there is one other thing which is always really beautiful. And professor in Harvard, Erica Chenoweth, has done analysis around all the social movements across the globe from 1900 onwards. And that really started around suffragettes, you know, when do you get voters' rights? Name it. It doesn't matter where, in which country it is. There are two things for success. One is it has to be nonviolent, which makes a lot of sense, I believe. But the second thing is if you have 3.5% of the population, change always happens. And 3.5% of the population is so much more feasible than a majority. You know, if we can get 3.5% together, and there my idealistic, opportunistic, positive sense comes in and think, we can do that. So if we are talking about what is next, what is my role there? Yeah, what is my role in that part? And how can I play a role in that? And that is what I'm discovering at the moment. Yeah.
What you're also talking about is, you know, we look at, I use the term schizophrenia, but you can also look at it from the standpoint of the Eastern kind of perception of the yin and the yang, right? Which is, and really mature societies really have a sense that there are different things that are always in place, and being aware of that is part of the, you know, the part of the success of leaders is the world is always going to be paradoxical. And so it's how do we balance the kind of decisions we're making and the connections we have.
Do you know, there is a Talmudic saying that I really love. that a man should walk around with two pieces of paper, one in either pocket. The first reads, "You are the center of the universe." And the second one reads, "You are but a speck of dust," for both are true. You're quite right.
Every what should culture... a woman walk around with?
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Oh, by the way, a woman's born more spiritually advanced, and that's why she doesn't need education, apparently. That's the justification of not allowing women to study.
Maybe true, though, from what I see. And I mean, they have those studies of the countries that were led by women in terms of COVID came out much more effective. So, look, I'm not going to argue.
I always thought it was an insidious argument, though, that you compliment someone but keep them from an education. It's a strange tactic. It is going to be time soon to send you to the moon. And for someone so outgoing and adventurous, I hope you enjoy the journey. But we're not sadists, so I'll allow you two other things to take with you. You get a snack, and an endless amount of that one snack, your favorite movie snack, and a book. So first, what will you bring to the moon to snack on?
It's an absolutely no-brainer. It's M&M's.
Oh, wonderful.
Plain?
No, the peanut one. Oh, in the yellow bag.
Yeah.
And I secretly imagine, you know, the whole moon covered. There should be a part of it where you kind of can lie in it.
We'll fill, we'll fill a crater. Movie. We'll fill a crater
with M&M's. Yeah, a crater with M&M's. That would be fantastic.
That sounds delicious. I'll join you. That sounds like a great way to watch.
Getting hungry, we're ready.
Do you believe the different colors have flavors, or do they just all taste the same to you?
No, I love the different colors. I do not make any choice. I have to eat the blue ones first. It's really a mix. And I eat so many of them, I always eat myself sick. I do not buy the tiny, you know, no. I go you for get family the... pack. This is the only time when I'm a finisher, I really have to finish the pack.
Well, they're yours. And I'm glad there's a little bit of protein in there, too. So that will do you really well. And look, what book?
This actually comes back to the conversation you just started. It's when West meets East and when East meets West. I just came from India, so I thought I'd do the Tagore book. It's called Gitanjali. They are all poems that he made and what is so special around India and its calmness and its spirituality. He got a Nobel Prize for it, and he wrote a beautiful speech at the inauguration of it, where he's really talking about the spirituality of the East and the kind of the West that keeps on, you know, creating new solutions. He could have said it in the now, even while I think it was over 100 years ago. It's such a beautiful connect. I think respecting each other's strengths, but also how we need each other to remain sane and have a beautiful humanity.
That's a beautiful thing to bring to the moon, where the kind of the East meets West.
Yeah, I was also wondering, if I'm on the moon, you know, and aliens do arrive, then maybe it's a little bit about, instead of where East meets West, it's also about where do we meet others.
Well, look, I like the image of you sitting in a crater full of M&Ms, deciding to write the next edition to that book, which is Where Earth Meets the Intergalactic.
Go for launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Roger, go.
Bye, Willika!
Safe travels.
Crew one for all.
Have a great time.
Thanks, pressing for strawback reject.
Thanks very much. Yeah, no. You have to come soon.
Save some of those M&Ms.
I want to see Skyfall on the moon.
And it's configured for flight.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Stage one propulsion is nominal.
Power and telemetry nominal. Vehicle supersonic.
Moonsnacks is sponsored by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with host Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman and special guest Willika van Rijn. It was produced, edited, and with original music by me, Ben Pleased.
Highlands and Islands Enterprise is the economic and community development agency for the north and west of Scotland. If you're interested in seeing how we can help you, contact us at hie.co.uk.